Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During this edition of the show, we give you access to local physicians and public health experts with information on COVID-19 and recommendations related to it. If you have a question for our guests, please email it to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181.
Good morning. It's Wednesday. Wow, Wednesday, going over a year now of doing these programs. We started out like 5 days a week, you know, and then we cut it back to once in a while, and just then into Wednesdays, and that's been going on for 6 months. And I had no idea a year ago that we'd still be doing this a year from them, and it looks like we could continue doing it for another year, maybe. Who knows? I don't know. We keep talking about maybe morphing it into something different, but it doesn't really seem like we're anywhere near the end of this pandemic. Cases are back up statewide again. Locally, they're back up again. And there's new waves surging through different parts of the lower 48 and through different parts of the globe. And we just keep getting bad news seemingly every day in regard to whether the vaccines work, whether the vaccines are going to be actually on the market, whether now some of these variants are going to be more receptive or more infectious to kids. Then we ended last week a little late after tackling an online question we had about alternative treatments and conspiracy theories, and promised we'd spend this week talking about conspiracy theories. We'll do that a little bit of, but as usual, we have a few questions from listeners to tackle first and would welcome your questions as well. There are some that already came in online. And we're switching things up today for fundraising week a little bit, and we're going to broaden the discussion by bringing in our fine young reporter, Dylan, who will sit in and co-host this morning. He has a whole raft of questions to ask Dr. Theobald. Dr. Mortensen and Dr. Jones are unavailable today, but we are again graced by the presence of Dr. Shanna Theobald from the Kodiak Ambulatory Care Clinic. So we will dive right in. If you have a question, you can shoot us an email, lowdown@kmxt.org. Or give a call to Pam, 486-3181. Make your pledge at the same time if you're a supporter of the program. And we will try and get your question answered before the end of the show. So, Dylan, welcome. Shanna, welcome again. Let's dive right in.
Were you opening with listener questions?
Yeah, I'm going to open with the questions that we got from people online, which the first one is...
And, of course, thank you for having me.
You know, the first one is kind of morphs into what you were talking about, what we were talking about, the conspiracy theories. How do we fight, someone wants to know, how do we fight misinformation?
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Big, huge question.
That is a big question. That's a great question. We've kind of addressed that before. Sorry if I sound like, I'm a broken record, but I think... Investigating. Right now, there's a really great article done by Voice of America reporting and looking into conspiracy theories and why they're so abounding in this pandemic. And of course, you know, part of it is the politicization of the coronavirus. And it really does kind of unfortunately tend to follow party lines rather than public health information. Also, social media has been incredibly, like, they've done studies to look at, you know, where is this most information coming from? Where are people getting their, you know, whatever conspiracy theory it is? It's from social media. It's kind of upset the stage more than, you know, very differently than it ever has been in the past for viral, you know, things to go viral. And a person who might make a statement one day cannot retract it if they, you know, read something and realize, hey, I was wrong about that. There's no way to get that back because it's gone viral and it's spread. And even if they put something out, that might not go viral, depending on, you know, what people kind of want to hear and want to see or believe. So I think the most important way to combat that is if you see something, especially on social media, research it, look it up, look at what, you know, the scientists are saying about it, the medical professionals, the experts. And if you hear something from even a medical expert, look it up again. Don't be, you know, look at everything with a healthy dose of skepticism, even like Dr. Osterholm says, what he is saying, what I am saying here, what, you know, just do more. I think we need to do deeper, more research. And viral memes are simply that. They're not well-founded scientific or medical information. They could come from anyone's desk anywhere that may or may not know really what they're talking about. So.
If I may jump in with both a plug and a question, first off, I would like to say I cannot answer this as a healthcare professional, but I think that always a good way to fight disinformation is to support your local media projects, among them KMXT. We are doing our fun drive right now. And we programs like this, we are able to do because of your donations. Now, with that plug out of the way, this leads perfectly into a question that I have. So in this country, and in many Western countries around the world, we take steps to regulate certain businesses from the interest of public health. Among them, for example, are cigarettes. Do you think that there is a public health impetus to regulate the social media companies and other platforms that fail to adequately control fake news and disinformation?
Yes, I think that's first a great question, and I've thought about this a lot. We have freedom of speech in the United States, and that is a right that is very dear to everybody. It doesn't matter what party you're from, you know, what you believe, freedom of speech is important. There are limits to the freedom of speech in the Constitution. And basically, you know, if you're libeling somebody or
fire in a crowded theater.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There are kind of specific limits. And I think this is potentially can fit into one of those if you're spreading disinformation. And also the businesses that own these social media do have the right to, you know, set the guidelines that they think are appropriate, and spreading misinformation is something I think that, you know, Facebook's gotten a lot of flack for censoring or silencing information, but I think, you know, it is their right to do that. And if it is misinformation, it makes sense to me to not spread that. Just, I mean, people believe almost anything, it seems like. And so it is important to know, to understand how humanity works and how people work, and then to respond accordingly, that basically thinks about the safety, like you said, from a public health perspective. Public health is all about prevention and, you know, safety of the general population. And I do think there is responsibility in having that kind of a platform. But you are, just to address what you first said, you are absolutely right. We talked a little bit about this on a prior episode.
Right.
Media makes such a difference in a community. They looked at this during the influenza pandemic, and the towns where public, you know, the media was speaking about the influenza and informing people about what was going on and also what to do about it with masks and social distancing, washing hands, those locations had less of the disease burden and death from the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic. And it was a really interesting social experiment it turned into kind of, you know, looking back and getting the data, because the government was telling people, you know, we're in the middle of a war, we don't want to destroy morale, and basically directing the media to not talk about the influenza pandemic. So what you guys do makes a huge difference. And I think very much this show and what you've done to get the information out is probably partly responsible for how well Kodiak has done through this. Put that plug in there too.
Well, let's turn it over a little bit. Not everybody listens to public radio, you know, of the media sources that are available to people, there are media sources that move into the conspiracy theories. They support it for some, you know. I do not understand the gain that people get from spreading misinformation. What benefit is it to, you know, to a person who creates intentional misinformation to then put it out into the world? I mean, there are some people that are more gullible and they don't do their research and they accept whatever is on social media or on the some of the news channels, and then they spread it. But why would somebody create it in the first place?
Are you asking me? Or?
Well, you as a reporter, I mean, you as part of your regular job fact-checked all the time.
Right.
So you get a piece of information and you know where to go for a trusty resource to
right.
check whether or not it.
I can give, and I guess this is more broadly an example, but I think one of the classic ones is Alex Jones's InfoWars. So he has always sort of shot really from the hip, and sometimes, you know, it's just outright outrageous, complete frivolous nonsense, and it makes absolutely no sense. But if you ever look at his program, I don't particularly encourage that you do, but you'll see that, and there's been a ton of reporting on this, like in the last few years, every single program begins and ends and is completely vivisected by these different segments where he's trying to sell you things. So he makes, and you know, this is sort of a good examination of fake news in general, because you have all of these like different sticking points that they'll sort of insert in. They create the most outlandish content possible. And if you see it and if you believe it, it's the most riveting thing you've ever seen. I mean, of course, like the classic statement that they're turning the friggin' frogs gay, right? I mean, that's crazy, right? You want to find out more. Are you familiar with that clip? There's a very famous clip of...
No, I missed that one.
Well, there's a very famous clip of Alex Jones where he's saying that they're putting this chemical in the water and they don't know what it does and it's dangerous for you and it's turning all the local frogs in the area gay.
How can you tell?
I don't know. He was quite certain of his findings, but you're creating the most engaging possible sort of idea, and people are there and they're sitting in front of you and you have their attention for a set amount of time and you have very high intensity as far as their intention goes. And then at that point, if you say, here are these virility pills, things that'll help you grow your hair back, etc., like all these different supplements and products and what have you, things that you need because they're coming to get you, you roll it into one concise pitch, and then you have a dedicated and highly engaged consumer base to then sell those products to.
Well, that was where the reference was seemed to be going with the question about the doctor in Idaho last week. We know that the marketing part, there are people that create these falsities on purpose so that they can gain financially from it. But there's some that are just so outlandish, no, it doesn't appear that anybody's monetizing them. You know, there's the one that... the test swabs cause cancer. You know, that was going around the internet for quite a while. I don't know why anybody, you know, maybe they sold other types of test swabs, but it doesn't make any sense to me why that would go out, you know, to dissuade people from going to get tested. The allegation that by getting a vaccine, it would cause a miscarriage. People were quoting like there was a 360% increase in the amount of miscarriages that were occurring in the United States because of people who were getting vaccinated. You know, that was one. When you hear it, you immediately question it, and you can go someplace and find out whether or not it's true. But it's still out there.
Mm-hmm. I've seen two things in this. The first is just observation from my friends and family on social media. One is when you decide that a pandemic is not real or is a hoax or is caused by a political reason, when you think that and believe that, all of the information you receive after that is going to have to fit into that belief. And I've seen my friends and family, you know, instead of just taking information and analyzing it, it's has to kind of fit into this structure, this pre-existing structured belief. And so it gets twisted, things get made up. As soon as there's one little piece that might support your statement, like for example, the test swabs causing cancer, that can help kind of make the pandemic seem, or make the people who are saying, you know, that the pandemic is real, as opposed to the crowd that's saying this is a hoax, it's going to help kind of bolster, you know, every little thing. The vaccines have problems. The swabs cause cancer. You know, this was released in China. All of those types of things are going to kind of fit with that particular view. And once you kind of take that stand, you're going to stand for it no matter what. This is what I've seen, I think, as an observation. And it's interesting. And I think it's on both sides. People just tend to do this. It's a human. It's kind of how humans are, I guess, are wired to think and believe and try to support what they have taken a stand for. The second thing is, when big events happen, people have to come up with an explanation for it. And a lot of right. times it's when something's really complex or troubling to kind of understand. And I mean, we saw this after, you know, September 11 attacks, the moon landing. There are things that people just maybe can't wrap their minds around, and so create like a conspiracy belief around it. They need explanations for big problems. And for them, I mean, and also, you know, with the politicization, I think people were trying to kind of explain why our president would be saying this is a hoax, and try to fit all the data into that statement, versus actually looking at what's happening, not just in the United States, but globally. And that theory then falls apart, because this is obviously not an American, you know, right. thing for political reasons. This is happening everywhere. But yeah, I think it is. It's fascinating to kind of see how it's playing out socially.
We can continue that line, but I got a question from a listener about the Pfizer vaccine. How long is the life of the Pfizer vaccine? And do you have any idea when a booster might be needed?
Yeah. So right now there's still, there was just a recent article that came out, I read last night, that there's still a good 6 to 9 months out. We're getting the data from July of last year when they started the phase 3 clinical trial. So we're moving into a year now. And it takes time to see, you know, if you have an exposure after, you know, 9 months after you've gotten the vaccine, how good is your response to it? We have, you know, they have measured antibodies and those have dropped off, but that doesn't necessarily mean that immunity has decreased. There's a chance that it can wane. And I think a booster shot is likely going, there's a good chance that a booster shot will be needed just because of the variants, in addition to possible waning immunity, but we're still figuring that out. But so far, the data 6 to 9 months out from receiving the vaccine shows that there's still really good immunity from those shots.
So is it your understanding then that we're going to be coming back like every year or so, kind of like the flu shot, and getting an updated COVID-19 vaccine for the indefinite foreseeable future?
Yes, it is looking more and more like that might be the case.
Well, that's problematic if it appears that the war, the social media war, is convincing people. In other words, just today we heard a couple of doctors on NPR talking about how we're never going to reach, we have this resistance pool of 30-35% of the population that's just adamantly opposed to getting a vaccine. And with the virus not having moved really through the population as of yet, we have one doctor predicting that we're going to be in this pandemic for another 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, it is concerning. I mean, when you look at states right now with the B.1.1.7, the surge is occurring even where you have a third of people vaccinated. And again, we've talked about this, the more people vaccinated, the closer to herd immunity through either, you know, vaccination or prior infection that we get, the less chance this virus has to spread around. But 30% is not enough. Chile has one of the highest vaccination rates, around 40%+ right now. And the current surge, they're rate of increasing infections is skyrocketing. So if we look around the world to see, you know, who's been vaccinated and how it's playing out, it doesn't we are not even close to herd immunity through vaccination in the United States. And yeah, unless we get there quickly, we are behind the curve on B.1.1.7. Even if we get there as quickly as possible at this point, we're still in big trouble with the surge. And the variants that are coming out, that's another, you know, big kind of picture of how this is actually going to play out with the, even with vaccines, is still unknown.
So not to be like cold or insinuate that, you know, some group of people have a cold outlook in any sort of way, but really quickly, can we get into why, even if you've had your second dose and you're all vaccinated up, you should really be concerned about this trend, even if everybody you know and all of your immediate circle is vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at the CDC at this point recommends, you know, vaccinated people can hang out with vaccinated people on a small or limited basis, but we still need to continue our prevention strategies at large, you know, outside of that small group, by wearing the mask, keeping our distance, and then washing hands frequently until we reach herd immunity. And the longer it takes us to reach herd immunity, the longer we're going to be having to do these things. So there is, like for Kodiak, there is tons of vaccine available now. The vaccine far out kind of outweighs, or there's more vaccine than demand at this point. So there's no, you know, get your vaccine, because this is the only way that we're going to keep protecting our community through this next fourth wave that, as Dr. Osterholm, he's been predicting it. We're seeing it play. We were skeptical that, oh, maybe we really are on the backside of the pandemic now. And we're seeing it play out. The surge in Alaska, the lower 48, is ramping up. And I mean, Kodiak, we've been really lucky here. I think a lot of people have done a great job here. I think the information has been getting out more in Kodiak as far as, you know, what we need to do to stay safe. But we're not out of the woods yet. We're not fully, I think we're about 42%. We've gone up by about 2% each week of one vaccine and around a third of full vaccination. So we still have 2/3 of the population not vaccinated.
Right. I know we have plenty of listener questions, and I don't mean to suck up all the air out of the room, but are you guys now beginning to encounter the plateau of vaccine reluctance?
Yes, it does seem that we are not able to get the vaccine in the whole state, and definitely here in Kodiak as well. We are plateauing, and yeah, we're meeting that resistance that Mike just mentioned as well. People are waiting. They want to see how it plays out. The problem is we don't have time to see it play how it plays out. That happened to one of our patients. That patient got hospitalized and medevaced, and the concern is that with the variants coming in, our community, you know, people still can get sick from this, and we can still spread it around. So don't wait to get vaccinated.
But the worst news we got, right, is the news on AstraZeneca and then the new news about the Johnson & Johnson. And doesn't that, no. I mean, you can argue that it's, you know, the cost benefits of it are exceed the remoteness of the possibility that you're going to get sick. But it's going to increase the reluctance of the people who are already somewhat reluctant to want to go get it.
100%. And I think that's one big reason why the FDA decided to put a pause on it. I mean, there's been 6 cases of this rare type of blood clot in the brain. And out of 6.8 million doses in the United States, and very similar rates. So one per 1.1 million, one out of 1.1 million recipients of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine had developed this rare blood clot. Same rates in Norway with the AstraZeneca, and same rates in Germany with the AstraZeneca. They're very similar made vaccines, and they're looking now at how it activates an autoimmune an autoantibody to a platelet function. So basically, there is a causal link that is being published now that established by this. And I think, again, it's one in 1.1 million. And COVID virus itself causes significantly more blood clots. I was reading some studies, you know, up to 1 in 3 hospitalized patients were having blood clots from the virus itself. So it makes me wonder if the vaccine and the virus are triggering this kind of, I don't know if the mechanism is the same for causing blood clots, but again, I think the fact that the FDA has, you know, called for a pause on Johnson & Johnson vaccine shows to me and everyone that they are taking this extremely seriously, you know, that we're being much more cautious. And I hope that kind of increases people's trust in what's going on, because we do want the vaccine to be safe and effective and not cause more harm than benefit.
Same kind of logic would apply to the vaccine breakthrough. And we had one in Anchorage with a lady who hit social media the other day who'd been fully vaccinated and then got COVID. Then you have this number, 200 some cases out of Michigan with, I believe, 3 deaths out of 236 people. And those kind of cases are popping up. But I'm thinking the vaccine isn't 100%. It, you know, there is a small percentage, but if you're a gambling person, you know, almost 600,000 Americans have died. And if we're talking about, you don't want to be one of the 600,000, but you might get a blood clot and it might kill you, but, you know, you might get hit by a horse too.
Yeah, I mean, nearly 3 million people now have died from coronavirus, and you're right, 600,000 in the U.S., and we are... I mean, the fatality rate, the morbidity rate, so things like blood clots from COVID are much higher than vaccines. And also, I think it's really important for that reinfection rate, 230 cases out of around, I think it was 2.3 million people, that's 0.01%. So 0.0001 out of, you know, so one out of, what is that, 10,000 people are getting reinfected. And of that, it's even a smaller percentage of fatalities. So they're still extremely, extremely effective. The one, I mean, I think we're just so lucky here in Kodiak. We have primarily Pfizer vaccine and some Moderna. We did give out some Johnson & Johnson vaccines here. We only got, I think, like 42 doses for our clinic. And we gave out maybe half of those. So they are recommending, you know, for people who did receive the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, pay really close attention if you're having any symptoms at all of shortness of breath, severe headache, you know, any strange symptoms, get seen just to make sure that it's, you know, they're not one of the lucky 1 in a million people who are going to have the blood clot side effects. But I did want to put that information out there for people who have received the Johnson & Johnson. And we are no longer going to be administering those, obviously, here because of the hold. So I just, yeah, want to make sure I kind of put that information out publicly.
So if you are one of the 42 people and you got the shot a week or two ago, those are the symptoms, shortness of breath, headaches?
Yep, shortness of breath, headaches, you know, any swelling that's unusual that could show signs that your blood, there's a venous clot and the blood is backing up. Any chest pain, shortness of breath, and really any unusual symptoms at all, doesn't hurt to just get checked out for.
Okay. Now, Dylan's got a whole raft of questions there, but I want to give you the one listener question and comment here before we move to him. Looking globally, what's happening in Sweden? Are there any other countries following the Swedish example?
As far as the... how they've kind of stayed open throughout the pandemic, or as far as what?
There was a lot of talk about Sweden and them being different when the pandemic first started. Then I know that it didn't pan out and the circumstances had changed and people wish they didn't follow the Swedish rule for a while, but I'm not.
I thought their whole shtick was radical herd immunity by just making no rules.
Right.
That has been what they're doing. So just kind of looking at updates, they have the highest new COVID cases per, you know, 100,000, you know, per capita in Europe. And they've had, compared to their other Scandinavian neighbors, they have had much higher death rates per population. They're, you know, not a highly populated country. They're very kind of similar to Alaska, but exceeding all the other kind of comparable countries in Europe. And that is largely due to that kind of the strategy of getting to herd immunity by letting, by kind of staying open and letting people just get infected. Infections in ICU patients have surged. They're still, their death toll isn't as, you know, isn't trending that right now. But I think the public health information that we've had throughout this is true in Sweden. It's true in any country. The more people that get infected, the higher rates or the higher, you know, mortality, the numbers of mortality people are going to die and get sick afterwards. It's, that's true across the board.
If I might ask one question following up of a topic we briefly touched on earlier, as far as people who have already been in vaccinated and are reinfected, to be clear, right, they have a significantly lower chance of severe illness. They're less likely to become long haulers. They're less likely to be hospitalized, right?
Yes. Yeah, that is another really excellent point. Yeah. All of those are improved following the vaccination, and even one dose of the vaccine is better than none.
Did you have another listener comment, Mike, or did you want me to jump into these?
The comment that the person made was in regard to trying to convince people. It's saying it's easier to convince somebody of something than it is to try to tell them they've been fooled by it.
Mm-hmm. I'd certainly agree with that.
Yeah, there's a lot of psychology studies done looking exactly at that, and it is true. We are prone to bias, and we are prone to wanting to be right and thinking we're right, even when all the evidence can disprove it. And people will still hold on to that belief. And it's really, I mean, you know, we can tend to be a little bit delusional sometimes. It's really interesting. I don't know why biologically that is the case. It seems like, you know, survival would depend on not being that way, but it is. And it's proven to be, I mean, even the, some of the smartest people I know, you just can't, the data just doesn't get through that firewall.
I was reading a book about this sort of psychology once, and I think what I heard and what I read in the book was that people are incredibly efficient at finding ways that they're being taken advantage of, so efficient that they often flip backwards into being taken advantage of.
That is fair. That probably is where it kind of the, that survival skill, quote unquote, developed from is, yeah, trying, you know, being skeptical and not wanting to be taken advantage of. Exactly. And then there are people on both sides that are completely taking advantage of that.
Right.
Whether it's for power or popularity or, you know, to increase their numbers on their radio show. it's fascinating to see. A lot of people are so skeptical and yet believe all of these just complete myths that are easy to disprove. And it's interesting to see how it just doesn't make a difference to put all the data on the table.
Did you have another question, Mike?
This is a pretty hot question, as a matter of fact, but I'll let you jump in. There are churches telling members not to get vaccinated. What do you do? Is there something that the public health system can do? Is it a governmental thing? Is it, you know... We've already had a couple of Supreme Court decisions come down recently about interfering with religious freedom. How do you know?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't know. I don't know that I have a good answer to this. Someone else, you know, in ethics or higher up would probably have a better answer. It's sad. It's irresponsible to have a platform and use it to spread misinformation that is ultimately going to harm the group of people that are trusting you. I think that's really unfortunate that there's you know, that platform in a church. I think, again, this shouldn't be politics or religion. This should be public health information, or, you know, it should be about public health and what does the science, what does the medicine, what does the data say? Yeah, I don't know why somebody would use that platform to push an anti-vaccine message.
Well, there's a lot of discussion over the last year about churches and not using their pulpits for political purposes. And in response to that, you know, then there was a movement from certain members of Congress to try and make an exception so that their nonprofit status wouldn't be jeopardized by allowing them to have political to use their pulpit for political purposes. I wonder whether the same hammer could be used in terms of, you know, putting their nonprofit status at risk for spreading anti-vaccine messaging. It's just a question. I'm not giving you an answer. I'm just wondering from a medical standpoint of it, you know, and sometimes we don't want the medical people to get involved in politics either. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting question. Dylan, you have one of these conspiracy whoppers you'd probably like to pose.
Oh, yes. Actually, so I do have an interesting question, I guess, a little bit to that vein. So I suppose that it's probably not controversial at all to say that doctors have had an increased role in recent years as far as being, for many people, one of their only touch points as far as diffusing conspiratorial thinking goes, whether it's, you know, vaccines causing autism or, of course, more recently with the COVID-19 vaccines. Do you think that the responsibility to diffuse conspiracy theories belongs in other areas of public life, and where specifically should that be? Do you think that it is right for doctors to be called upon to have this degree of participation in diffusing conspiracy theories?
Yes, I think, you know, part of our training is to provide accurate medical information to patients, to people, and to know the research and do the research and make sure that that's kind of what we're following and also providing to people. So I think, and ethically, yes, absolutely, we have an obligation to make sure people understand the truth and get this public health information. I mean, whatever helps the society be healthier, stronger, better from a clinical standpoint. Does that answer the question?
I suppose as well as anybody could answer it. You know, it's the reason that we're here, I guess, is because there are really no easy answers to this. You know, if this is something that we could just do away with, we would have already done so a long time ago. And I mean, this is something we've been fighting to do for a year and something we'll be probably fighting to do into the next year.
But what you do is you, when faced with a new issue, dive into it to get as much information as you possibly can to give people the best answer you can give them, which is why we appreciate having you on the show, because we collectively don't know the answers to these questions. We were faced with something completely unknown and, you know, kind of had to plot our way through it and learn a little bit as we went along. So getting the most current and update information is the best thing that we can do. In that light, I have another question from someone who wants to know, do you think the increase in cases is due to people, to vaccinated or unvaccinated people transmitting the disease?
Unvaccinated people. The cases that we've seen are people that have not gotten their vaccine yet. And the ones that, like we kind of talked about, the one that got sick and hospitalized and then medevaced to a higher level of care due to COVID problems, was waiting to get their vaccine. What we're seeing a lot of is the vaccine hesitancy. And that's, I mean, the other big thing is we might be done with the virus, but the virus is not done with us.
Right.
And it won't be done with us until we have taken the appropriate protective measures to keep it away from us, which is essentially vaccine or staying, you know, staying apart until it kind of passes through or plays out. Yeah, the really unvaccinated population is who's getting it now.
There was one question I really wanted to get to, and I guess using myself as an example for a little bit. I'm Gen Z. I'm a Zoomer. I was born in 1998. I got my first iPhone in middle school. And young people today are getting access to the internet at an even faster rate than I did. And I really do believe that young people are really seeing both the best and the worst of the messaging around like COVID-19 vaccines. Are you concerned from the public health perspective that the upcoming generation might be at least as conspiratorial, if not significantly more conspiratorial than the last one?
Sorry, but the upcoming, what was that word?
The upcoming generation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a really, that's a great question. I don't know how that's going to unfold. I would hope that with all the information out there and access to information that people will, you know, be able to research more and see, really get to the scientific data. But again, there are those generators of misinformation that are very, like you said earlier, they're very popular and they have such a, you know, exciting appeal, that I think people do, we are still biologically wired to kind of get caught up in that excitement. And so I don't know how it's going to play out. There'll be a lot of probably interesting case studies that come out of this that we'll learn, that we'll get to learn from, and hopefully, you know, put in some parameters to help people be more cautious about what is being published into the Ethernet. But yeah, that is a good question. I hope people will be smarter about it and more well-researched.
Let's talk a little bit about Dr. Fauci, since we should talk about him at least once a week. I believe, you know, he came out this week and said, even though he is fully vaccinated, that restaurants are out for him, movies are out for him, he's not taking any trips, he will only go indoors with people who have masks on.
Yeah.
You know, so if, and that's not the same messaging we're hearing from the CDC. That's just somebody being more cautious.
But the CDC is saying that it is okay to get together with vaccinated people, but to still maintain those mitigation measures in public. And that's the same, I think, even the traveling recommendation, they're not recommending that people travel. It's basically, if you have to travel and you're fully vaccinated, here's what, you know, what you need to do. But every expert is saying and doing the same thing. They're basically staying in their own lockdown, because the more people go out and intermingle, the more chances for that virus to spread and mutate. And we're not at herd immunity yet. Really, we have to, before we can say we're probably home safe, is when we get to closer to the herd immunity. So closer to, you know, 80% of the population being vaccinated. And until then, those that understand the science and virology and how viruses spread are going to be staying still essentially, you know, distanced, maybe not quite locked down. They'll still go out to the grocery stores, but wear a mask and, you know, continue to follow those mitigation strategies that we were even early on in the pandemic.
Well, it's sort of contrary to the feeling that you get after you get your second shot and you think you're home free. You know, you're,
right.
You see,
yeah. I mean, it does allow people to get together again with other vaccinated people. And that's where it's just great when your friends and family are vaccinated, because there is that freedom now. And that's what, yeah, I think that's, I mean, all of my friends in Kodiak are vaccinated, which is wonderful, because we are made to be, you know, have connection, and relationships are so important in our biological, you know, wiring. And so we can do that again now when people are vaccinated, and that's great.
I know Dr. Mortensen talked about it at length a number of times about how he has the talk with people who come in, but how about us and some advice for us who have to have the talk with people in our family or a close friend who won't get vaccinated, how do you have that discussion and what can you do other than beat your head against the wall?
Yeah, I think bringing the data is so important because, you know, people are looking at the vaccine adverse effect reporting system, VAERS, and saying, look at all these bad things. They're not looking at those bad things first compared to the general population, and then second compared to the COVID virus itself. And when you look at that, the adverse effects are no more than the general population, and compared to the coronavirus itself, it's tremendously, tremendously safer than getting the virus. And it's, and people still have this belief that the virus, you know, getting the virus is less dangerous than getting the vaccine. It is absolutely 100% not true that getting the virus is safer than the vaccine. Yes, some people are asymptomatic. Most people that get the vaccine are asymptomatic. You know, the majority of them have a sore arm and, or some fatigue, and some don't even have, besides a sore arm, everyone, you know, that is a local reaction that is pretty common. But a lot of people don't have any side effects at all other than that from the vaccine. So I think that's one big thing, really looking at those sources and then finding a source that they trust. For example, my mom is religious, and it was a religious leader who was, you know, a doctor in a nursing home as well, who really talked about the vaccine, the safety, the efficacy, and how it's so important to protect our elders. And the way he explained it just met her where she was at in kind of needing that information. And so I think finding those resources that people trust and getting that information out too is really, can be really helpful.
If someone is listening to this program right now and they're at the point where they're not vaccinated, you know, maybe they have some sort of conspiratorial reservation as to why they wouldn't want to go, what would you say right now to that person?
I would ask them what their reservations are and kind of take them one at a time, show them evidence, show them, you know, whatever information is helpful in countering those, that belief, whatever the particular beliefs are.
So where would you say that we're at as far as this conspiratorial thinking goes, at least as far as you're encountering it in the medical context? Do you think that this is a battle that, you know, people who are in the business, such as we are, of countering disinformation wherever we find it, do you think that this is a trend that is increasing, that you're encountering more and more of these situations where you have people who are coming to you with a medical opinion that they've gleaned from, you know, wherever their source is on the internet? Or do you think that people are starting to have some degree of self-defense against ideas like those?
That's a great question. Kaiser did a study about vaccination hesitancy. And in September, 63% of people said they would take the vaccine. And then in December, 71% said that they would take a vaccine as long as it had been studied and shown to be safe. I think in general, as more of the vaccine is available and more people are getting it, more people are coming around to saying that they will get it. Now that the majority of that pool has been vaccinated, from a, you know, boots on the ground perspective, we are meeting more and more of the resistant. Obviously, the holding out population at this point is the population that is resistant or hesitant and wanting kind of more information, or has a lot of beliefs that are misinformation that does need to be countered. So we are encountering it a lot more, but that's because the population that's willing to get it has kind of already stepped up and gotten it.
Right.
Does that kind of answer what you're asking?
I guess another question that I have is, Do you think, so we have certain institutions right now where in order to participate in those institutions, you have to have a certain battery of vaccines. Among them are like public health, public universities and public schools. There are certain vaccines that you absolutely must have. For military service, there are some that you absolutely must have. Do you think that from your perspective as a doctor, do you think that adding the COVID-19 vaccine would be prudent for some of those institutions?
Yeah, that is a great question. I am kind of in the same camp as Dr. Jones. I don't normally push vaccines. I, you know, hear people out and kind of give the information, but I mean, at the end of the day, it is patients' decisions. I think what would be ideal is that people have enough information to understand that this vaccine is safe and effective and they want it for their kids. And that information will be coming out in the next few months. If variants develop that are significantly worse as far as, I mean, this one's already bad. In kids so far, I think the wild type virus has been less problematic, but if there is a variant that develops that is more problematic in, you know, children, I think at that point we would really need to look at the risk versus benefit and how much it's affecting children. And you know, if there's significant mortality, you know, kids dying from it, and morbidity, so kids getting the multi-system, you know, inflammatory issues in children, or other significant problems that lead to long-term complications, I think that at that point, the medical community would make a very strong recommendation to protect our children. This is really, I mean, it's so important to protect the kids and keep them safe. And so I think that would be the information needed to make that recommendation.
Well, there is some indication that the pediatric admissions have been going up.
Yes.
And that the B117 may have increased transmissibility, and it may go beyond asymptomatic in kids too.
Exactly. Yep. That's, we're getting that data now. And I think that will be a really important factor. And also, as of now, the Pfizer and Moderna have good efficacy against B117. So if kids, you know, as soon as kids can get vaccinated, I think we're going to hopefully see that those rates improve. But if another variant comes out that is resistant to the vaccine, then that's going to be another game changer. We're dealing with a different virus right now. We're dealing with a different variant. And so we can't, I think it's important to understand that we've got something different that's passing through the United States and Alaska right now. And so we have to treat it like we're kind of starting a little bit backwards towards the beginning of this pandemic with the new variants.
Well, that is, with what's going on in Brazil and Chile, mm-hmm. that is a different animal entirely, right? The P1 that we don't really have a lot of data on who's being infected and who's dying down there. It just sounds like the numbers are out of control.
That's happening. Yeah. They had a huge explosion of P1 cases in Canada too, I believe, out of the Whistler ski resort.
Right. Yep, that's exactly right. One of their ski resorts, they had it basically kind of fired off a new forest fire around Canada, and it is the P1 variant. So we are going to be getting more and more data about that, and who knows what other variants are in, you know, being created at this point too, that we'll start seeing.
Well, let's close with this question, which I'm not sure maybe you're aware of, maybe you know the answer to, but someone was concerned about the reporting delays that seemingly are occurring in Kodiak, where we're not getting really good data, and it creates a false sense of security, I think, that, you know what I mean? We may be at a higher risk level in the community than we think, because for some reason, you would think that after all of this time, reporting data would be would be almost instantaneous as long as they've been working on this, but they still seem to be having some problems. Do you know anything?
Yeah, so here's what's happening. When a person tests positive in our clinic, it's usually on a rapid test, and then we send it out for confirmation, and we send that report to public health. Unfortunately, we don't have public health any nursing staff on island right now, so it gets sent to Anchorage, and then they are the ones who report it, I believe, to the EOC. And you can see the EOC will say, you know, today we had 5 positives that dated from April 9th or what, you know, whatever the date of that actual diagnosis was made. It's about 4 to 5 day, it seems, reporting lag. Based on what I've been watching on the EOC. And it is hard. It's also, you know, we want to be accurate and just make sure we have the accurate test that we're publishing. And then it does need to go through public health, which has been kind of understaffed and underfunded for the last few years. So that is part of what's happening. But I do think just knowing that the variant is out there and we are not getting great genotyping for Kodiak or Alaska at this point, just presume that it's here and take the same precautions. Kind of like when we had testing issues earlier in the pandemic, we're just, you know, saying presume that it's here and if you're sick, you're positive and act, you know, behave accordingly.
Yeah, we're still having community spread cases, right? Would you say that the information as it exists right now is accurate insofar as, you know, our understanding of exactly to what degree of penetration it has in Kodiak at present, or would you say that it's sort of a moving target?
I think it's somewhat of a moving target. We do the reporting right now. I mean, we're in the green zone, and technically we should be in the intermediate to high zone because we've had depending if you look at the 7-day or the 14-day average, several to 4 to 13 cases per 100,000. If we, you know, less than 5 is the greens, less than 5 new cases on our average 7-day kind of period or 14-day window, is the green risk zone. 5 to 10 is the intermediate yellow risk zone, and above 10 is the red high risk zone. Mm-hmm. So we've really been in the yellow to red. And I think what isn't being portrayed is that we keep saying that we're in the green zone, or at least that's what I've seen on the EOC website, and we really aren't. And I don't know that people are aware of those changes. And there is a lot of community spread. There is a lot of, you know, we don't exactly know where a case pops up and we don't know how they got it. So that tells us that it is creeping around, secretly, silently creeping around in Kodiak. And yeah, it is still here, and it can take off in the 50% of people that aren't not yet vaccinated, or, you know, 60% partially vaccinated.
Another cheery week on the lowdown.
Yeah. One of these days.
Well, you know, one of these days we would think that we're going to celebrate and not have anything to talk about. But
we get vaccinated.
Yeah, the goal is to one day have a lowdown where we bring on a bunch of doctors and we talk absolutely not even at all about the vaccine or the virus. we're just catching up. You know, you guys gonna barbecue? What's going on? You know,
everyone's gonna love that day.
Well, but then you hear those reports that this is the warm up for the real COVID that's coming 3 or 4 years from now. You know?
Don't even say that.
it does seem like there has been a proliferation of these type of viruses over the last 15 years, does it not?
Absolutely. And that is one thing that they found when they kind of investigated in China. There is a lot of predecessors of wild type viruses in bats that look very similar to this, you know, SARS-CoV-2, and also the MERS and SARS viruses. And then they did not find any evidence of very similar coronaviruses in the lab, and no one had gotten infected in the lab. There's a lot of information that kind of came out of that investigation report, but it is true. And this virus has spread to minks, the cat family, dogs. I can't remember all the animals, but it is a virus that once it mutates and it finds a host. And that is important. I hope we've learned a lot from this coronavirus pandemic to better address if there is, you know, there will be future pandemics because that's what viruses do. But hopefully we're getting a lot of really good, important information. And, you know, the vaccine platform, this is a the mRNA vaccine platform is incredible. One doctor said it's like going from the, you know, the buggy, horse-drawn buggy to a jet, because we were having to like incubate the flu virus in egg, in eggs and all, you know, basically grow it in a lab, which was very difficult. And now we can just get the mRNA strands that we need pretty immediately. So there is a lot of hope and kind of scientific breakthroughs that have happened here. And I hope that we take that into we will take that into the future with us.
Right. I hope so. I got swine flu when I was younger and I was sicker than a dog. That was not a fun one.
That we got lucky that one kind of blew over fairly quickly. Yeah, a lot of people got vaccinated really quickly too. But there are other viruses out there that who knows what they'll do.
So you should get this vaccine as soon as you can.
Yes. Luckily, we've got all the Pfizer and we have tons. We have, I think, probably 1,000 doses at our clinic now of the Pfizer. So come and get the vaccine. And the data on Pfizer Moderna has been really incredible. You know, they haven't had some of the same problems that Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca have. They don't have the same blood clot risk. So they are still proving themselves to be very safe and effective.
Lastly, as a primer, if you want a vaccine, where do you get information to go and get it? How do you get that scheduled?
Yeah, so all the clinics you can call, and Safeway and Walmart also have vaccine allotments. Our clinic, we have, you know, I know most about our clinic, so that's what I speak to most, but we have tons of vaccine available. And then also through the DHSS, the Department of Health and Social Services, you can just search DHSS Vaccine Alaska, and they have all sorts of information on there, including, you know, where to go and get it, the numbers to call. And just more like just general information about it.
Well, thank you. It's been another fun Wednesday. I hope very informative. We got a lot of great questions, a lot of good answers, and there'll be more questions and more answers probably in weeks to come. So
thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. It is always great to see you. If you support the program, give us a call. We would love to hear from you on Hump Day, Matching Day.